The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Revenge against the elite for City. A stunning turnaround at the Bernabeu gives Pep's men the upper hand in the Champions League last 16 as Sergio Ramos sees red for only the 26th time in his career. Is Serge Gnabry the best player in London? Bayern Munich tear Chelsea apart at the Bridge. Elsewhere, Barca need a late equaliser in Naples and Lyon beat Juve for the first time ever. If you can't remember all the way back to Monday, we'll remind you of Liverpool's latest victory as West Ham pushed them close. There's plenty to discuss in the Football League and a cup final to look for. To that, plus your goals scored below the waist and above the knee, and other questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, hello, Paul McInnes.
Hiya, Max. You all right?
I'm really well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well too, thank you.
Oh, that's marvellous.
Just walked in the snow.
Is it snowing now?
Yeah, it's snow. I mean, it's like mainly sleet, but there was a bit of snow.
Okay. Is it... I can't think of the word.
Lying.
Is it lying? Is that the word? Lying?
It's far from lying.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Well, we can only keep our fingers crossed. Hey, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
Nice to see you.
It is.
Yeah.
It's nice to see you.
Oh, thanks. Hey, Barry.
Hello.
Are you well? You came in, you looked quite dishevelled when you came. You looked like you just walked down Mont Blanc or something. You had a big coat on and a woolly hat and you were all wet and your glasses were steamed up.
Yeah, that's about the size of it. There's no way to start today. Well, basically, my feet are wet.
Oh.
And that's just no
but
good.
Did you walk from Brixton?
No, I walked from King's Cross.
Settling is the word for snow, not lying.
Sticking. It's regional variants.
Sticking.
And you can't prove otherwise.
I'm going settling. Thank you, producer Jonathan. Anyway, let's start the Bernabeu, shall we? Real Madrid 1, Manchester City 2. And there was quite a 10 minutes, really. Real 1-0 up in a game where... not a whole lot had happened, and then Jesus scored, Sterling won a penalty, De Bruyne scored it, and then Sergio Ramos was sent off. Did you see that turning point coming, Lars?
Really, no, because going into this, I mean, Guardiola, for all the amazing things he's done in his career, before this game, he'd only won 6 out of 26 knockout games away from home in the Champions League. So his record in these encounters is actually quite poor. With City, he's beaten Schalke and Basel, you know, well done there. With Bayern, they beat Arsenal, I guess that counts for something. But in terms of a really big win away from home in a knockout game, we have to go all the way back to Barcelona beating Mourinho's Real Madrid in 2011. In that sort of bizarre game where Mourinho played Pepe in midfield and Real Madrid had 3 shots in the entire game. It's a long time ago. And there are 2 things that always seem to be present when things go wrong for Guardiola in the Champions League. It's a surprising or strange team selection or formation. That's one thing. And the second factor is that once they do concede one goal, the team tends to freak out a bit and concede a couple more. So when the team lineup was a bit odd and unusual, and the first goal against them came, you do think that, oh, here we go again. But instead, they didn't concede any more goals. Perhaps slightly fortunate, Real Madrid could have scored one more, but they held out. They showed tremendous resilience. Guardiola did change the shape of the team, moved Kevin De Bruyne back into, you know, midfield, and put the Jesus up front and brought his best winger on from the bench. And suddenly things made a lot more sense, and they were by far the better team in the end.
Tom says, why does everyone keep saying that Pep chose a weird team? He had a world-class winger playing instead of Sterling, top-class striker instead of Aguero. It's not Gundogan on the wing against Liverpool. It's an amazing depth in squad.
I take that point on board, but this is, you know, probably their biggest game of the season as things stand, and given the background of it, it's made even more big because there's a possibility of them being banned for a while. And going into that match with probably your best striker on the bench, your best winger on your bench, and your best defensive midfielder on the bench is a little bit weird. I'm sorry, but we should stress, of course, Pep Guardiola is a deep thinker of the game. I think it was one of the Bayern directors who said that he perceives the game in a way that we almost don't understand or something like this. And he's obviously been studying Real Madrid very closely. And I'm sure the lineup and the formation was the way it was because he has spotted weaknesses that the likes of you and I cannot perceive or pick up on. But I do notice that when his best midfielder was put back into his best position and the striker played up front and the best winger was on the pitch, they suddenly seemed to look a lot better.
I mean, it's very hard for Pep to pick a team that isn't good. But he does have a reputation for overthinking these European knockout games with City, and he's, you know, come unstuck. And if they'd lost last night, he would be getting slaughtered in the press today for, you know, this weird team he put out. Because I was certainly a bit baffled by it. but it worked. So when it works, great, you're a genius. And there's a very fine line between, you know, looking a genius and looking a complete idiot. But he fell the right side of it on this occasion. So hats off to him.
Was that a foul by Jesus for the header?
No.
I don't know how much you have to be pushed to go from just flicking that ball to not flicking that ball.
Yeah, I guess it's at the discretion of the referee. But for me, it looked like Jesus was trying to stabilize himself, basically, and that Ramos was actually backing into him and he was trying to stop him doing that. We're talking about, you know, what changed in that 5 minutes. And I do think the addition of Sterling really transformed the game. And he was able to chase down the balls down the channels and they could start putting the ball over the top a bit more. He was the one who chased the ball into the corner, played it back to De Bruyne. De Bruyne, incredible piece of retention of the ball, little turn, sent two people, and the cross was stood up. And it was a slightly ungainly header, and there's definitely some sort of suggestions that Courtois could have, maybe should have, got a whole hand onto the ball. But I think Jesus did all the right things, even if he didn't execute it perfectly. He did all the right things to make it difficult. And you know, City had benefited from being conservative in the first half hour because it allowed them to go into the game. And I think, you know, there was a mistake that led up to the Real Madrid goal, but I think, and the 10 minutes after that. But other than that, I think City had the best of the game and probably certainly deserved the equaliser.
And is that the real credit we give Guardiola, is that he approached this game in a slightly different way to other games games City normally approach, or games in the Champions League? You sort of remember them going a bit more hell for leather in other games.
Well, yeah, they're conservative against Liverpool in that quarterfinal. And that undid them. I mean, they got turned over. But I think today, the attitude was there. They looked like a team who'd been playing together for 4 years and looked like champions and looked like they deserved to be on that stage. And maybe that shape, where they weren't risking too much, also gave them a bit more confidence.
Yeah, it's possible. I was being a bit harsh in assessing that it only sort of turned when they fixed it. I mean, they were the best team in the first half as well. They just weren't creating a lot of things. On the push, I mean, it feels like a thing we've seen. We have seen those disallowed for that. And I did, there was a part of me that thought when it went to VAR, like if this was sort of CSI Stockley Park, they would have gotten the microscope out and sort of, oh no, there's a hand in the back there, we must rule this out. But, you know, there was an element of common sense there, happily. And I
is
guess
that maybe, how they talk in Stockley Park?
Maybe in my head, yeah. And maybe
comedy
it's also
Irish
just that.
Whoopi de Hawkey! This was offside! Begorra!
And they're like, why is David Coote talking like that? Shouldn't he just be focusing on the actual game? Anyway, what were you saying?
It could also be just a result of just all the negative football karma that Sergio Ramos has built up over a long and slightly, you know, balmy career coming back to bite him. On that later.
Well, I mean, more of that now. It's his 26th sending off of his career. But actually, Barry, that probably keeps them in the tie, right?
Yeah, look, I love Sergio Ramos, and we have every time he gets sent off, we have this sort of rolling Sergio Ramos red card retrospective, and you know, we just add the latest, and it gets loads and loads of clicks. It's great. It's the gift that keeps on giving. But I mean, he took one for the team last night, and you know, I wouldn't blame him for that.
Joe Weston says, by my very rough calculations, he's now been banned from playing for more than a regular season of games. Can someone verify that is iconic? According to Transfermarkt, he's missed 41 games through suspension. That'll raise to 42 in the second leg. He could have just had a gap year if he'd been clean. He could have just gone backpacking.
That's why he's kept at an elite level for so long in his career, because he's had rest at just the right points in time.
Where are Real Madrid now? You look at the front three and you think, that isn't a front three that terrifies me. And you think, well, Modric is a beautiful player, but he must be 94. And Casemiro's a brilliant player, but you sort of think the same.
Well, Miguel Delaney went on Twitter last night and said, you know, that guy is Thomas Roncero, the ass
yes.
columnist and Real Madrid cheerleader. He was on TV weeping at how bad Real Madrid are. And, you know, Miguel obviously speaks fluent Spanish, so could understand what he was saying, and said he was just whinging like a child, saying we will never win another match again. So he's obviously thinks they're in a bad place. I mean, I was kind of surprised by Paul and Lars. I got the vibe he considered this some sort of a shock. I fully expected Real to win last night.
Not a shock. It was just, it felt, when it looked like Guardiola had overcomplicated, I guess, a little bit with the lineup, and when the first goal against them went in, there was this sort of weight of recent history and the sort of, oh, here we go again. I mean, they were favoured to get a result with the bookmakers, and I think that's entirely fair. Listen, when they were winning, when they went on this sort of run and winning a bunch of Champions Leagues, Real Madrid with Zidane, there was always this sense that there wasn't any sort of tactical genius behind it. They didn't have an amazing style of play or anything. And, like, I don't have contact in the Real Madrid dressing room, but I've spoken to someone who has, who also confirms that they don't do a lot of, like, specific tactical stuff. But back then, you had sort of peak Sergio Ramos marshalling the defence. You had peak Luka Modric pulling strings in midfield. And you had peak Cristiano Ronaldo scoring over a goal a game. I mean, if you have those sorts of things going on, maybe you don't need a genius tactical plan. You just need to keep them fit and happy, and they will rise to the occasion. If you look at the team right now, as you say, Max, they don't have those things anymore. And I think, actually, Zidane's done quite a good job getting them to a competitive place in La Liga. They've conceded very few goals, and he's had to find ways of winning games. But I guess the hope was that they would all raise themselves on an occasion like this week, and it didn't really happen.
Manchester City have lodged an appeal with CAS against their two-year ban and their fine. Ferran Soriano, City's chief executive, is hopeful that the process will be concluded by early summer. If it's not done by the 23rd of June, when next season's Champions League starts, they will be eligible to play in next year's competition. So this will be hanging over the team in fifth as well now. That is interesting, isn't it? Because,
well, it's interesting and kind of unfair, probably on City and on whoever's finishes fifth, but you know, the wheels of justice tend to move very slowly.
Well, I mean, you'd wonder, if you were City, would you be hopeful of getting it done soon? I'd almost be hopeful of dragging it out, and then you play it next season and sort of kick the can down the road. Yeah, is that a political phrase? Anyway, you mentioned there, you know, where Real Madrid are and how good they are. Bayern Munich, who won 3-0 at Chelsea, were absolutely sensational in this football match, weren't they? They had three shots on target in the second half, three goals. I mean, they dominated from start to finish. So many brilliant performances in this game, Paul. I don't know who to single out for praise. Yeah. I thought Thiago was, it was like a dream performance from a centre midfielder, but I mean, you can pick who you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to make a brief comparison with Real Madrid, I mean, this Bayern team has evolved. And it has young talents that are coming in and embedding themselves into the team. But they still look cohesive. And I think Real didn't quite give that vibe. But, I mean, I watched it on catch-up, the Bayern game, and I knew that moments were coming. But when I saw that Alphonso Davies assist for the third goal, I sort of, like, instead of, like, focusing on it like in a journalistic way, it's like what precisely he was doing, I was just carried away with it. It was just mesmeric. It was beautiful that the way in which he sort of did it so effortlessly. You see people like Speed Merchants and they're really head down trying. This was just balletic.
Yeah,
you know?
He's an amazing player, isn't he? And he's
kind of the story of that game, wasn't he? Or certainly in the build up, because I suppose most people know by now, but his parents fled Liberia and he was born in a refugee camp in
Ghana.
And then they moved to Canada, and so he was playing for MLS. And now he's a 19-year-old regular in the Bayern Munich starting over, and he is brilliant. And by all accounts, a very, very nice young man as well.
And it's quite remarkable. Just a mini journey is not quite as remarkable, but he's been on a mini journey since signing for Bayern as well, because he was a winger for the Vancouver Whitecaps and much more sort of an attacking player. And when he came to Bayern as part of a sort of small winger spending spree, like they saw the retirement of Ribery and Robin afar, and they signed him. They wanted to bring in Hudson-Odoi. They wanted to bring in Sané. They had Kingsley Coman is there. It's like, chuck a bunch of wingers into the mix. Like, some of them will turn out good. And he looked kind of out of his depth, and like this was a big, too much of a step. And this season he's been used as sort of an emergency left back, partially due to injuries and stuff. And he's just really taken to it in a truly remarkable way for a guy who hasn't played as a defender much at all.
Another thing, and there was a clip from beIN Sport of Wenger talking about this, and I don't know if you've seen this, but he'd made this observation. He said, it is interesting if you like to look at the numbers, because this emergency shift has come since both Hernandez and Sula have had long-term injuries at centre-half, which has meant that David Alaba has had to go and play there and actually significantly improved their play. That their passes in the final third have gone up by more than 10%. Their expected goals are up. So it's kind of like it looked like a total footballing team. Everybody could play on that pitch. And then they just did some brutal, straightforward, grown man football things that just completely overwhelmed Chelsea.
Yeah, too. I mean, just finally on Davis, there were a couple of times where Mason Mount got clear, and it was almost like Davis said, "I'll give him 5 yards," and then the next one, "I'll give him 10, and then just catch up with him.
And I guess this is the thing: he might not be an instinctive defender, but he's got such incredible recovery speed that he can just make up for a lot of the time.
We've already talked about how, you know, Serge Gnabry being brilliant in London, isn't he? Richard Jolly's of many stats. He's now has twice as many goals in London this season as Sebastian Haller, 6 compared to 3 after getting 2 in this game after the 4 he got against Spurs. His finishing, because someone, I think Mundial put together those goals, and his finishing is effortless. He made all those goals look so easy, and they weren't easy.
No. But he was super aggressive, and just wanted it. And I think there wasn't, with all that Chelsea, all the Chelsea team, they looked like you could see their thought processes going on every time they would look to pass the ball on to a teammate. And Bayern just knew. And I think that sort of takes a bit of pressure off. If you're so well conditioned, both mentally and tactically, to know what is required of you in any given situation, difficult things become a bit easier.
And they've got, in Lewandowski, they've got, you know, Chelsea had the choice of Giroud, who can hold it up, or Abraham, who can get in behind. And Bayern Munich have those two players rolled into one in Robert Lewandowski.
And who's got really good vision as well for one of the Gnabry goals. A lot of forwards would have gone for the finish there, and he just saw that the cutback was on. And he's remarkable. He's a very complete centre-forward. Maybe he doesn't have the sort of searing pace, but you know what? He's pretty quick for a guy who's past 30 and quite a big frame. He really gets around the pitch very well. He has a little bit of everything. He's an absolutely terrific striker. And his form this season is like something like 25 in 23 domestically, and before this game it was 10 in 5 in the Champions League, I think, yeah, off the top of my head.
So 39,
this is bizarre goal scoring for him, really extraordinary.
He's out for a month, actually. Yes. Fractured his leg caused during the game, but he finished it, which is even more impressive than Son, you know, fracturing his elbow and playing on with a leg fracture and being that much better. The team that beats them in the Champions League has a very good shot of winning it, basically.
I think I want to see them play City in the final.
Yeah, that would be exciting. I think the interesting thing, I think worth mentioning Hansi Flick and the job he's done here as well, because the ill-fated Niko Kovacs, who managed to win the double last season in Germany, which is why he stayed in the job. I think there was a great force of will in the club wanting them out already then, but it's kind of tricky sacking a double winging coach, so he stayed on. But he, in one of his sort of latter press conferences before losing the job, he said, shortly quote, he was asked why they didn't play with the sort of energy of Liverpool, for instance, and he said that we can't try to go 200 kilometers an hour on the Autobahn when you have a car that can only go in 100 kilometers an hour. You must simply accommodate with what you have. And this was a very unpopular thing for the coach to say, basically suggesting that the players wouldn't be up to playing this sort of pressing game. And he was replaced, and Hansi Flick has clearly worked on reinstating that sort of in-your-face, high-tempo, aggressive way of playing. And it seems to be working very well for them. There was a great interview with Thomas Müller this week in The Athletic, where he explained as well that the lads, they also see that it's more fun chasing a ball when you get a reward for it by creating chances up front. It's less fun to chase the ball only to be able to play it sideways outside your own box. So this is the thing with the whole high pressing thing. You may have to do a lot of donkey work and run around, but when you do catch people out, the goal is right there, you know, so there's a motivating thing there.
Barry, I haven't seen anyone being particularly critical of Frank Lampard. It's just Bayern Munich are better than Chelsea.
Well, it was a humiliation. And I'd say it stung because he played against three or four of those Bayern Munich players in 2012, was it? But it was men against boys, and you can make excuses for Chelsea. They're, well, I was going to say they're quite a young side. Bayern actually had a younger average age than Chelsea, the Bayern team that beat them has a younger average. But Chelsea are more inexperienced, I think. But some of them were made look very, very pedestrian and ordinary. Like Ross Barkley was humiliated. Reece James, I thought, was humiliated, and I think he's a very promising young player. Marcus Alonso was humiliated. And if I was the England manager and I saw that game, I'd have a lot of, it would give me a lot of food for thought when it comes to picking my midfield for the summer.
Yeah, I've been trying to work out how much, you know, because I think Chelsea are a worse team this year than they were last year. And last year there was, you know, a lot of almost insurrection in the terraces about, you know, it was the style of football as well as the results. But, you know, Sarri had a 62% win percentage over the course of the season. Lampard's currently at 49%. They didn't look like they had a plan. They didn't look like they had a cohesion to them. And I think he reverted to having Giroud in the team. And
who played very well against Spurs.
Yes, did play well against Spurs. And I think he's a decent forward if you've got the right players around him. If you look at the sort of Lewandowski comparison, where was the pace around him as a forward to make the difference? And I just think he's caught in between blooding the youngsters and saying, okay, this is a complete reboot, and saying, well, we're Chelsea, we're in the Champions League, we're in the top four, we should be there. And I think he's caught a bit between pillar and post, and I don't see what their identity is at the minute either.
But they're at the, I mean, you talk about teams in cycles, you sort of think they're at the start, they're sort of at the start, and at the same time you have to try and win the game that's in front of you, I understand.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, I don't see it as a humiliation, I just think they come up against a way better team.
That's certainly true. I'd just be slightly wary of this sort of, I think he referenced it after the game, Lampard, that it's a learning experience for them and stuff. But, you know, they had three players under 25 on the pitch. I mean, this is not some team of highly gifted toddlers.
Mm-hmm. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll round up the rest of the Champions League.
Too often in science podcasts, we hear voices not of the people who might be affected by new discoveries, but of those who made them. What if we flip that on its head?
Like, my father's 50 and praise God that he's still alive, but that's through kidney transplant, ripping a vein out of his leg to put in his arm. That's through having 8 units of blood every month, and that's touch and go if he actually gets that. This could stop that.
With our Common Threads podcast, we travelled around the country to hear people's questions, hopes and fears when it comes to something called gene editing. It's a technology that could one day allow us to rewrite our DNA.
Actually, my son has severe learning difficulties, so he doesn't have capacity to make any decision for himself. I'd say that he's very happy in his skin. The only person that has suffered because of him is me. Would I change him if I could? No.
My daughter's got an extra chromosome, and I would absolutely delete that. And it's not to change her, it's to change that extra chromosome that holds her back.
It's important as well to give context, because we're all here and we're all people of African origin, and I think that very much shapes our response to things like this, because our history of being abused by science shapes us.
To have a listen, just search Common Threads on your podcast app or head over to theguardian.com, where you'll find all the content from our Gene Gap project.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly live shows coming up just over a week's time, 9th of March in Glasgow. A few tickets still remaining. Snap them up, please. Lars and
is
Philippe.
Is it the William Shatner live we're struggling
it
to compete
is,
with?
Yes, it is.
Because I think if Philippe is there, he can do a cracking sort of spoken word as well, I think.
Yeah, we'll get Philippe to do Common People.
Yeah.
And maybe that'll get
good.
Them to sell the last few tickets. So we've sold out.
I'd set for you just turning up on time, Lars.
Oh, but I don't need a passport this time. So
this
be
is
fine.
True. You should be okay.
We don't have a Glasgow contact to sit in for you for the first 20 20 minutes.
Sold out in Edinburgh at the Pleasance on the 10th. Thanks all for getting your tickets. 23rd of March, we're at Earth in London. In Hackney, 9th of April, we are back in Leeds. The lineups were due to be announced today. They're being announced on Monday. We're keeping you guessing for now. Right, Napoli 1, Barcelona 1. Two lovely goals. Lovely finish from Dries Mertens. Beautiful move for Griezmann's equaliser. What did you make of this game, Lars?
Well, I mean, I think Napoli would be almost a little bit disappointed because they'll feel they did a lot of things right. They were able to soak up most of the pressure. Barcelona didn't create that many chances. There was a lot of sort of Kike Setien-esque sideways passing going on. And listen, Napoli are a team who have, on the one hand, they have a lot of problems. They're a group of players who I think will most likely be broken up in the summer. They have big names and big personalities in the dressing room who are likely to leave. Mertens' contract is expiring. Callejon's contract is expiring. Alan is probably going to go. There's a possibility that they'll cash in on Koulibaly. So they're guys who have been really sort of pillars of this team for the last few years who are coming to the end of their time there. And they're also involved in this sort of legal dispute with their own club over this sort of mutiny that happened a few months back. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but since the turn of the year, I mean, they've beaten Lazio, they've beaten Juventus, they've beaten Inter, so there's a lot of talk. We have this other three-way title race in Italy. They've beaten all three of them. So Gattuso has sort of found a way of getting the team together, gotten them to show some fight, show some grit. They've changed the formation back to 4-3-3, which everyone seems a bit more chilled out with. And a few months back, when the draw was made, you think, oh God, this is going to be terrible for Napoli, but they really held their own in this game.
Do you still give them a hope?
I wouldn't write them off because I think this is a Barcelona team that's entirely capable of the most awful calamities in the Champions League. We've seen that the last couple of years. And I don't entirely trust them under Kike Setien. And Napoli, there's some fight in this. There's some raging against the dying of the light for this sort of group of players who never quite achieved what they probably should have under Sarri. And I think are enormously motivated to try to make a go of it here.
Is there a similarity with where Barcelona are in terms of it? I know when you watch Barcelona, a lot of it seems to be give it to Messi. And that is not a bad idea, right? It's not, we've only got one option. It's a really, really good one. But it feels to me there's quite a lot of that with Barca.
And it also sort of covers up whatever absence you have elsewhere in the team as well. If you can always, it stops you from working on them to improve them. I think they've also got a lot of injuries right now, and I think Piqué is going to be missing the return.
Yeah, he rolled his ankle, looked really sore actually.
Yeah,
and so, missed the Clásico as well, which is the weekend.
Yeah, so I think Napoli should definitely go into the second leg. Will go into the second leg with a degree of confidence.
And Vidal will be out as well. He got sent off for two yellow cards, which he got in one move, which is always impressive. He committed a late tackle on Mario Rui and then squared up to him and did one of the rutting stag touch heads and then push. But he pushed much more than Rui.
I believe those two constitute a full house on the Arturo Vidal bingo card.
Right, Lyon 1, Juve 0. Lyon beat Juve for the first time in their history. And before this game, Sarri's Juve had scored in 34 of their 35 games. So impressive to shut them out. Baz, you did the MBM. Did they deserve it?
Lyon, yeah. They started on the back foot. They defended deep throughout. It was kind of like the way Atletico went about it against Liverpool, but without the pressing, and they confined Juve to the flanks, and Juve just didn't play well. There was crosses going awry, they were shooting from distance, but shots going high and wide. Cristiano Ronaldo, I think, came into the game on a run of 10 consecutive games he'd scored in, and I think he'd scored 13 goals in those 10 or possibly 9 games. He didn't score. He didn't have one of his better games. Spent a lot of his time, you know, sort of looking sad and disappointed with his teammates. I wouldn't particularly fancy Lyon's chances of going through, but they certainly deserve that win, and they could possibly have had another goal or another couple.
De Ligt was off the pitch when the goal went in. He had a sort of Terry Butcher head wound when Lucas Tossard scored. Does anybody think that you should, like rugby, should be allowed a blood substitution?
No.
Okay.
I don't think his absence made any difference, to be honest.
Really?
No.
Huh.
You can maybe roll it into concussion subs if that's if that's where we end up. But it doesn't happen that often.
No, true. It was just an idle thought.
Well, I suppose if you... He would have happily played on. but he was ordered off because he was pouring blood from a head wound. So I suppose, you know, you could argue, well, it's not fair.
But what's the idea? Do you have to send a centre-half to warm up so he can come on for 5 minutes while someone's getting bandaged and then tell him to sit back down again? Like, this would be weird.
Well, that's what they do in rugby.
Yeah, it would be weird. I don't know. It just feels unfair when a team
sure.
is down to 10 men, not through fault of their own, and the other team score a goal. It just doesn't... I mean, you say it wouldn't have made a difference, but he is a...
Well, I'm only speculating, yeah. but I don't think it would have made a huge difference.
He's another human being where that ball might have been. I mean, it's impossible to know, right? Juve had two late shouts for a penalty. One for a push on Ronaldo.
I don't think that was a penalty. I certainly think... I think it was Bruno Guimaraes, who I think is only playing his second game for Lyon, appeared to wrestle Paulo Dybala to the ground in the penalty area as he tried to control the ball. And I was very surprised the penalty wasn't given for that.
Barry, I didn't watch this because I was all about the other game, but sorry.
No, you were all about ruining rock bands by adding a letter to the
name.
Well,
it was a very boring game for a while there. Things went out of control on
Twitter. What did you go for? Add a letter to a band to
add a letter to change it. There were some good ones.
Small feces.
You see, I went for Shakespeare's cistern, but...
It doesn't count.
It doesn't... You have to appeal to the judges.
Tweezer.
Okay, yeah, Tweezer is bad, isn't it?
Sled Zeppelin was pretty good.
Anyway, crack
Irony
on.
Maiden.
Okay, come on.
There's a lot of good stuff. The Bland.
Yes,
I like.
Right.
That was pretty
Ketchup
good.
Ketchup Boys.
Okay, very good. Oh, no. Yeah. No, because...
Pet Shop Boys I had. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, that's better.
It doesn't mean anything.
Carry on with the football.
Smogwai.
No.
Okay, fine. What I was going to say, Barry... Because I saw Sarri said after the game, again, do you remember when Sarri was in England? He would either say nothing at all, or he would be way too honest in his press conferences. It was either one or the other. And he's been on the honest side of it. He said after the game, I don't know why I cannot get the players to understand the importance of moving the ball quickly. This is fundamental. We'll keep working on it, and sooner or later this concept will get into their heads. I continued to tell them, and they were many who were doing it, moving the ball too slowly and therefore getting into the wrong positions. Do you recognise this criticism from the game? Were they moving the ball slowly?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I'm just looking at their lineup. There's a lot of very experienced players there. You know, It's not like he's trying to explain the fundamentals of the game to a bunch of five-year-olds.
When you get to a certain age, it's hard to do anything quickly, isn't it?
Well,
really?
That's true.
Now, in the Europa League, only one game happened yesterday. Rangers getting through to the last 16 with a 1-0 win in Braga. Ryan Kent scoring the only goal of the game. They won the tie 4-2 overall. Huge turnaround after trailing 2-0 in Glasgow. Yanis Hadji missed a penalty right before half-time. They've missed 5 of their 10 penalties this season. Ali McCoist on TV at halftime going, I'd hate to see a shootout between Rangers and Man City. It's a good line, isn't it? But that is a great result for Rangers, isn't it, Barry?
It's quite an extraordinary result, to be honest, because Braga have been tearing it up in Portugal and Rangers haven't been tearing it up at all in the Scottish Premiership. They've been awful since the winter break ended, and I was surprised by this, to be honest, and fair play to them.
There could be quite the British look in the next round. Early kickoff tonight, Wolves go to Espanyol. They've got a 4-0 lead. Arsenal host Olympiacos, having won 1-0 in Greece. Manchester United and Celtic have brought 1-1 draws home with them for their second legs against Club Brugge and FC Copenhagen. Now, on Monday, Liverpool beat West Ham 3-2. Barry, your exact words about West Ham from last time out were, I give them no chance whatsoever, none, absolutely none. And listen,
I was right. Next.
I mean, do you feel for them? I really felt for West Ham.
No.
Oh, why not?
Have you seen who owns them? Who their managing executive is?
Well, I felt for their supporters. I felt for the players. I felt for Fabianski.
Well, I would say Fabianski is a large part of the reason they didn't get anything from the game.
Well, a huge part of it, but I'm allowed. You're allowed to feel sympathy for. I mean, I'm not. Maybe I'm just not as merciless or as ruthless as you. Is anyone else? Where do you stand on this, Paul?
Well, I just Norwich did something similar the week before, and I didn't see a wide outpouring of sympathy for us. So West Ham aren't getting any from me.
Oh right. Nick Ames tweeted: this game can be used to argue that someone is going to beat Liverpool in the Premier League pretty soon, and also that there is absolutely no chance of that happening. I don't know. I just felt that David Moyes had a plan, and it looked like it worked. And I've from the West Ham I've seen in the last few weeks, I thought they had no plan. I thought they were basically definitely going down. And yes, they got no points from this game. But even still, I would leave that stadium with hope if I was a West Ham fan.
Yeah, I think it just sometimes a good performance against a team you're not expected to beat can be a bit of an outlier, really, as to your average level of performance. And it can be difficult to replicate. I mean, he went for a very defensive selection to start with, didn't he? He left all his creative players on the bench, then brought on Fornals and scored. So he made those changes. But then once they started to open up and try and go for the game, then, you know, there was more space for Liverpool to come into. And obviously assisted by an error, they did the job in the end. I think West Ham have the players to get out of it, but I think Watford have the players to get out of it. And neither of them both of them are still in the relegation zone.
Yeah, only the second time in all competitions this season the team has come from behind to be leading against Liverpool. The other one was during that 5-5 draw with Arsenal in the Carabao. Only the second time a team has scored more than one against Liverpool in the league. The other was Everton, who lost that game 5-2. Liverpool are back to 22 points ahead, a maximum of 4 wins needed from their last 11 games. They have the same number of points now as when they last won the league in 1990. 2 more assists for Trent Alexander-Arnold. What's my how good a Liverpool question? Like, what is it? It's relentless, isn't it? It's quite incredible. What they are doing is completely extraordinary.
Yeah, and while it is to be applauded, you wonder, is it a good thing in the cosmic scheme of things for the sake of the game and blah, blah, blah? But it is absolutely extraordinary that nobody has beaten them yet.
I don't worry as much about that because there is a huge problem with increasing inequality in football. But within the Premier League is not the worst example of that. I mean, if PSG were doing this in France when they have like 3 times the budget of anyone else, you go, ugh, this is a bit iffy. But Liverpool don't have like dramatically more money than the other top teams in England. They've just gotten a lot of things right over a couple of years that's culminated in getting this extraordinary team together with a coach who really suits the club, suits the way they identify themselves, suits the players he has. And it's all just working really well. And things have kind of broken their way a little bit in certain tight games as well.
I think it's really good for English football. I mean, just as much as anything, because Liverpool are one of the giants of the English game. They haven't won the league for 30 years. As annoying as it is for the rest of us, you know, it's a great moment for their fan base, and it's a great performance and a great achievement, and one that will, it's a good story. I think it's going to force other teams to up their game. They're going to have to be, you know, some of those who are in the mix. I mean, I think, you know, you see Arsenal, Man United sort of maybe going in the right direction slowly. Chelsea are going to have to do the same. Man City are going to have to respond. So I think it bodes well for the game in that regard. And yeah, I mean, it's just still quite great to watch. And in a couple of years, you know, you're going to have a situation where one of those 4 with 3 is going to go. You know, perhaps Van Dijk is going to want to go and play in Spain. It's not going to last forever.
Enjoy it while it lasts. You have to ride the wave, don't you? This from Aditya says, thoughts on Alisson's transition from hitherto untrustworthy short sleeves to now going full pelt with long sleeves and long trousers. Surely that's even more dodgy. Is he just changing clothes based on the weather? And we're overanalyzing. I'm going with treachery, he says.
I go with weather, although I have a deep mistrust of goalkeepers who wear long trousers or tracksuit bottoms or tights, anything like that.
I'm with you.
Why?
It looks wrong. It looks like they've just turned up a minute before a Sunday league game.
Right.
Even at my level, if a keeper has tracksuit trousers on, I think there's a before a game when you look over and you see the opposition keeper and they're short. Someone says keeper looks short. Test him, as opposed to keeper looks really big and good. Let's not bother testing him today.
Shoot when you know, yeah, sure.
Can I just ask you, if you felt sorry for anyone in West Ham? Do you know I kind of feel sorry for? I kind of feel sorry for Sebastian Allaire, who is actually, Sebastian Allaire has won more headers than any other player in the Premier League this season. He is up there doing his job as a target man. There's just kind of no one around him to do what Luka Jovic was doing in Frankfurt.
Surely, he normally flicks it on and then he has to turn around and get it.
I mean, yeah, I feel like he's he's being increasingly, I suspect, branded as a huge flop. And in terms of goal return, sure, they would have been hoping for a lot more. But I think he's doing a lot of things right, and he's to his skill set is contributing quite a bit. It's just not.
Yeah, you know, I thought Antonio had a brilliant game. I'd be interested. You know,
I think he's a great player.
You don't want to wish players away. If West Ham go down, I'd be fascinated to see at what level. You know, he would be. I think he could do a great job in a very good team.
I think he could be a good Wolves player. I think everybody could be a good Wolves player right now.
In the Football League, no movement in the top three, who all won. West Brom 4 points ahead of Leeds, who are 5 points ahead of Fulham, who won with a last minute winner last night. Leeds have now won more in their last three games than their previous 11. They won 1-0 at Middlesbrough. I went on Twitter last night to ask for some questions for the pod, and the first question came from Mike. I support Borough. Why do I bleeping bother? They've lost their last three games 1-0, winless in 11 across all competitions. The last time they beat anyone was on New Year's Day. Hull also haven't won in the league since New Year's Day. They lost to second bottom Barnsley, who made it three wins on the bounce. Well done to Barnsley. Nottingham Forest beat Cardiff to move past Brentford into fourth. Brentford themselves lost 2-1 to bottom place Luton. Three wins in four for Luton. The bottom is getting very tight now, just 5 points between 16th and 22nd. In League One on Tuesday night, the top two drew. Coventry won, Rotherham won. Portsmouth beat MK Dons to move back into the playoffs. They've got a game in hand over most of the teams around them. Tranmere have their first league win of 2020. An 11-game winless streak is over. They're still 5 points from safety. And Sunderland, who were on a 4-game winning streak, drew 1-1 with Fleetwood, who were on a 5-game winning streak. Joey Barton's post-match was fun, Barry. You'd rather come and pay to watch us than to pay to watch them. We play much better football. This is him talking to BBC Radio Lancashire. They're playing punt football. Two big lads up there in Lafferty and Wyke, who they've paid more than our total budget, and they're just banging balls at them. We've got to take real pride that Sunderland AFC, 3 years ago in the Premier League, have just celebrated drawing with little old Fleetwood Town in their old stadium like it was a World Cup final victory.
Yeah, Joey's face was a picture when Max Power scored an equaliser in the 7 minute of added time. And there was a bunch of Sunderland fans who had congregated around his dugout, who really rubbed it in.
Oxford won their third game in a row, 1 point off the playoffs. From fifth to eighth, there is a 2 point difference. Just two games in League Two. Cheltenham won their fourth in a row to go 5 points clear of eighth, just 2 points off third. And Grimsby beat Newport in a very mid-table clash. Neither are within 10 points of promotion or relegation. Just having a nice tight, drifting along for the rest of the season. That'll do for part two. Part three will begin by looking ahead to the Carabao Cup final. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. First cup final of the season, the Carabao Cup final, Man City versus Aston Villa. Big question, I guess. What kind of team does City put out for this one?
A strong one, largely because they don't really have any option not to. All their players are good. I think it's a trophy. They've always taken it seriously under Guardiola. I think they will win it. I think it's more of a concern for Villa, who are not in good form in the league at all, and also, you know, march them up the hill and then come down again without winning a trophy and potentially getting battered, which could easily happen. Might not be great for the morale either.
Dean Smith said players had played themselves out of contention for this game, Barry, but do you think he might have had a rethink since the dust has settled after that defeat?
I don't know. I'm looking forward to see who he puts out and if anyone does get dropped after their hideously bad performance last week. I don't think they'll be that bad again, whoever plays.
Goalkeeper is an interesting question, isn't it? Because Reina didn't have a great game.
No.
And who's your Norwegian?
Ørjan Nyland.
Ørjan Nyland. He had a really good... That just made some noises. He had a brilliant game in one of the... Oh, in the semi-final, God. I think. Was it semi-final against Leicester?
Yeah,
fine game.
Yeah, and he does... He does have those games in him, Ørjan Nyland. I might have said on the pod before, he kind of shot to fame in Norway by being a huge contributor to a very small club named Hud, winning the Norwegian Cup by just an extraordinary performance in the Norwegian Cup final. So he does have a history of sort of winning cup finals against the odds, not completely on his own, but not far off.
Villa fan Paul Flint asks, we're in a cup final on Sunday and playing for Premier League survival. Any chance you could spend more than 30 seconds talking about just our goalkeeper's pace? So on that line, of all the Aston Villa keepers you can think of, who do you reckon would win in the 100-metre sprint?
Nigel Spink.
So you're going Spink?
Spink.
Yeah. You think Spink would beat Friedel?
Bosnich for me.
I think Bozza...
Was he?
Depends at what level.
Was he
I'm not sure Bosnić could run for 100 metres, could he? I think first 20 metres, and then Bosnić runs out of steam.
Yeah, but he's built up such a lead by that point.
Do you think? Anyway, though.
Are we talking about them now or when they were actually playing football?
At their peak, at their absolute peak, you have all the Aston Villa keepers.
I'm struggling
all
to
times.
Think of any other ones, to be honest.
David James.
Yes, that's a very... I mean, I'd see him more proper middle athlete. Distance, but yeah, I think David James is a very, very good shout.
I'm thinking about just getting hyped for this cup final. Might go to the Morrisons in Colindale, where the draw for the first round was held.
Very good idea.
Just get the feeling.
It was a great day.
A pilgrimage.
It's quite close to a sort of oriental food market,
I believe.
It's
an amazing oriental food
market.
Yeah,
I've been there a few times. There's some nice selections there.
Some other suggestions, Brian?
If Villa win this...
Yeah.
I will get the Carabao Cup box out on Monday.
Wow, stop it.
I can't. Now, if that's not incentive enough for Jack Grealish and the lads.
Brad Guzan, producer Jonathan's given some other options. Ooh. Shay Given, Scott Carson, Michael Oakes, Peter Enkelman, Schmeichel, of course.
Peter Enkelman, wow.
Thomas Sorensen, who actually does a lot of charity bike rides up across the whole of Australia. So maybe Thomas Sorensen is...
Well, I reckon if it was 100 metres and you had 8 Villa goalkeepers... lined up in the starting blocks, and you put a Republic of Ireland cap just on the finish line, Shay Given would win by about 20 metres.
He never was very quick off his line, though, Shay Given.
Can you stop writing down Aston Villa goalkeepers now, please? Norwich-Leicester in the Premier League, Friday night game. We've got the A23 derby early on Saturday, Brighton versus Crystal Palace, which is a big game in the bun, bigger for Brighton probably because Palace have got a little bit of a cushion over them. Some people are trying to get the Gatwick and El Clasico into a phrase to change the name of the derby.
El Gatwicko.
Matt Scott was calling it the Quadrophenia Derby yesterday. As we discussed, I was listening to Jonathan Pearce saying his son supports both Brighton and Crystal Palace. I just couldn't work out.
That's just wrong.
I can't get on a high horse about supporting more than one football team, but that seems strange.
Can we not call it the Avian Derby?
We can call it the Avian Derby.
Seagulls versus Eagles.
Fine. The 3 p.m.s then, Bournemouth-Chelsea. Of course, Bournemouth won at Stamford Bridge earlier in the season. Newcastle played Burnley. West Ham-Southampton.
That's a big game.
Well, we've talked about West Ham's fixture list, haven't we? After this, away to Arsenal, home to Wolves, away to Spurs, home to Chelsea. So it's brutal, isn't it?
It's brutal till the end of the season, and it could be brutal well into the middle of next season, the way they're going. So,
West Ham, the second worst team at home in the league this season. Southampton, the fifth best away from home.
All right.
It's a surprisingly good away record, Southampton.
In the late game, Liverpool go to Watford. If they win that, of course, that is the most number of consecutive wins in the Premier League. Watford have really stumbled. Since Pearson arrived and had that little bounce, 4 wins in 5 over the festive period, just 2 points from their last 5 games now.
Yeah, that against some tough opposition, still got an issue around goal scoring, which I think has been a problem for Watford for a wee while now. And, you know, Deeney coming back into the team has made a difference in terms of morale, in terms of desire, but he's got a special set of skills, and you have to play to them and you can't do other things. And they're also missing Ismaila Sarr on the right-hand side, who was offering really good penetration down that wing. Delafeu, love the guy, but you can't rely on him to produce. So, yeah, it's tricky. And the thing is, you know, like I said earlier, they've got a good squad. I think they've got a good coach. I think they play the way that suits them, but they're still in the relegation zone. And that psychological effect is one you can't kind of quantifying can be very important.
The two Sunday fixtures, Everton, Manchester City and Tottenham versus Wolves. Any of 4 teams could end Sunday in 5th, which could be a Champions League spot. Rob says, ask Barry about Richarlison.
Yeah, an Everton fan, for reasons best known to himself, decided to organise a pile-on me on Twitter yesterday. So he took a quote I had said on the podcast when Everton paid 35 million or 40 million, whatever it was, for Richarlison, where I expressed my disbelief at what a ridiculous amount of money it was. And he wrote it out and turned it into a nice graphic and went, you know, hey, look what Barry said 18
quite
months
nice,
ago.
It had a nice background. It was one of those motivational quotes, but it was you talking about Richarlison.
Yeah, so needless to say, loads of Everton fans got the right hump and started saying how stupid I looked and how I knew nothing and it was typical biased journal, blah, blah, blah. And I sort of decided, hold on here, and had to go back. And I didn't really say anything that was wrong. It was a ludicrous amount of money to pay at the time for a player whose attitude was questionable. He appeared to have downed tools for Watford. He hadn't scored or provided an assist in, I think it was 31 games. And Everton at the time were renowned for spaffing huge amounts of money on players that didn't turn out to be much good. So I thought, you know, I'd stand over what I said at the time. And to be honest, I'd still be sort of inclined to stand over. The fact of the matter is, Richarlison is worth whatever anyone who feels they need him wants to pay. But he hasn't actually done that much for Everton. The season before they bought him, they finished eighth. If they play really well, now that he's made such a stellar contribution, if they play really well for the rest of this season, they could finish eighth again. If they up their game. He's provided 10 goals and 3 assists this season. Meh. You know, Timu Pukki has greater figures than them. And there were Everton fans trying to convince me he's now worth about 150 million. One of them pointed out, he said, since Richarlison signed for Everton, he has scored more goals than Son has for Tottenham, than Firmino has for Liverpool, and than Rashford has for Manchester United. So I checked. Nonsense, he hasn't. All three of them have scored more than this. I pointed this out to him, and he went, no, I'm talking about Premier League. And I went, well, it's still nonsense. Rashford has scored more than them. No, but Rashford takes penalties and free kicks, and he plays in Europe, so those goals don't count. Welcome to arguing with football fans on the internet.
Anyway, I think if I'm an Aston Villa fan, I'm a little bit perturbed that we've now spent more time on Richarlison than their upcoming cup final. But, you know, this is the way it's gone in this pod. I'm really intrigued about Wolves-Tottenham. Or Tottenham Wolves, I should say, because
I'm really terrified about
because
Tottenham
Mourinho
Wolves.
Has really set his stall out now after the last game, where he explained that if they press us high, they know that if we go long, we don't win a single ball against the opponent's defenders. If they drop back and go with low block, they know it's difficult for us to get into the box, especially from the side. So basically, Mourinho has said to his own players and everyone else, can't really play football at the moment. I mean, we can't. We can't play through teams. We can't go over them. Ah, sure, what can you do?
He pulled out that line, didn't he? It would be to qualify for the top four would be his biggest achievement in management, like finishing second with Manchester United. It's like,
but
you
I
know,
mean, is it not maybe his job to show them
absolutely.
How to coach the team?
I paid
like,
money.
What are they, what's the point of him if you can't? Yeah.
I paid money to go and watch that Leipzig game, and I just thought it was a capitulation before they even started. I just
do you wonder if he was a sea captain and they were in like a hurricane and the boat was sinking? And you go, oh, you see here, you know the waves, they're really big. What can you do? I mean, it's
I've got to watch the string quartet.
It's not ideal, is it?
He would actually. Every club is going to. If he was on that boat, the crew and the passengers,
the owners,
they'd believe him.
You know. But, and also,
there's no. You know, you could say, well, we could try and plug that hole, all the water. Nah, there's no point. Okay,
but also, Harry Kane's injured. We can't. You know,
he'd get in a little lifeboat to a really nice yacht, and then just that ship would sink, wouldn't it? Yeah. Dele Alli has been charged with misconduct over his social media post, where he filmed an Asian man in an airport making reference to the coronavirus. He's been charged with bringing the game into disrepute and of an aggravated breach of FA Rule E3, as it included a reference, whether expressed or implied, to race and or colour and or ethnic origin and or nationality. He's got until the 5th of March to submit a response. Speaking of the coronavirus, due to the outbreak in the north of Italy, 6 Serie A matches will be played behind closed doors this weekend, including Sunday's meeting between Juve and Inter, which could be pivotal in the title race. Inter's Europa League game tonight against Ludogorets will also be played behind closed doors. We talked to
Ireland's rugby match against Italy in the Six Nations has been postponed as well. Is this going to affect English football? I don't know.
What's interesting is there are discussions about the Olympics more permanently, but also people are starting to question this could have implications for the European Championships, but obviously it depends massively on how this
It's already a sensationally bad idea, the Euros, having them here, there and everywhere.
Yeah, true. Now, the FAAs of England, Scotland and Ireland have released new guidelines for 6 to 11-year-olds, saying they should no longer head the ball during training sessions. That comes into effect immediately. There's no ban on heading in matches. They've made this decision off the back of the report which came out last year, which suggested that former professional footballers were 3.5 times more likely to die from brain diseases than non-players. You wrote a report on this, Paul. I mean, it seems I spoke to Dawn Astell about it on Tuesday. She's obviously been campaigning a lot since her father passed away. He suffered from dementia, Jeff Astell, and she obviously said this is a good idea. This is the start, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you know, you've got to take your hat off to her and the campaign around Jeff, because I think that has driven a lot of the attention and conversation around this. So yeah, it's a. I mean, I think it may be the case that we're not dealing with the same situation as we once were. So that the game has changed, balls are different, people play football in a different way now. But I think it's safety first. You don't want to take any risks, and you know, it also conforms with the way the FA in general wants to develop players. They want them to play they want young kids to be playing the ball on the ground.
Awards. Congratulations to Marina Hyde and Barney Ronay for their wins at the British Sports Journalism Awards. Marina became the first woman in the awards' 43-year history to be named Sports Writer of the Year. She's also won Sports Columnist of the Year. Barney was named Football Journalist of the Year. The fifth in a row it's been won by Guardian writer Danny Taylor. Won it 4 years in a row. Well done to them. And in the picture of Barney in the paper, Barry, your shoulder was in it.
Yeah. Yeah, so well, as loath as I am to praise Barney, he really deserves that. And Marina is just outstanding.
They're so good at writing, it makes writing you not want to write.
Yes.
Yeah. a compliment for us, Nick B, 1981. It probably doesn't get said enough, but it was a wonderful listen from start to finish on Monday. It made cleaning the house and cleaning my tortoise tanks much more enjoyable. I'm less interested in the compliment. I'm much more interested in to know what people do while listening to the pod, and cleaning tortoise tanks.
That's a good question.
Is nice. So, yeah, do let us know what you like to do.
Walk the dog.
You walk the dog, do you?
I take long walks, and then if I'm doing household chores, I don't have anything as exotic as tortoise tank cleaning to attend to.
Presuming you don't listen to Football Weekly.
No, listening to other podcasts. Right,
okay. I listen if I'm not on.
Okay. JD32. Me too, actually. Faye, it was nice to listen to on Thursday. JD32 says, Max, referring to Dudley as Brummy, is possibly the worst thing he has ever done.
No.
I very much hope he suffers a minor inconvenience for this. Lovejoy92 says, the Dudley Town supporters were more likely to be from the Black Country than Brummies. Yam yams, if you like. It's like calling people from Sunderland Geordies. I do apologise.
I thought yam yams were from Wolverhampton.
Oh, well, let's not get in any more trouble.
Well, I've gotten enough trouble with Wolverhampton fans over the years, and deservedly so, but I remember addressing some of them as yam yams, and then they pretended to be offended.
Right, okay. So. Oh, I just move on to just stick with Everton for now. On the subject of Shane Long scoring a goal with his penis, John Broomfield pointed out that everyone missed a schlong joke in all of that. Thank you. This from Runar. Regarding your comments on Shane Long's goal at the weekend, our friend Klaus Lundekvam scored Norway's national team's 1,000th goal.
Yes.
With his knob, he says.
Yeah, and I mean, Lundekvam, famously useless on attacking set pieces. I mean, there was Strachan who once said that they might as well put a dead body in the area for all the good that it does them. And I think he also suggested that Lundekvam should be booked for time wasting when he comes up for corners. So, I mean, he's not a goal threat, but our goal number 1,000, he was right there, and he thrust it into the back of the net.
And on that area, Penny Lane Robin sent me this a YouTube video from 1997 from the washbag.com, a Swindon Town website. Portsmouth 0, Swindon 1. After Chris Hay gives Town the lead, Swindon's young goalkeeper Steve Mildenhall suffers a gashed scrotum after a collision with Pompey defender Robbie Pethick. With no keeper on the bench, Mildenhall is forced to continue an incredible series of saves and lucky escapes, seeing the Town scrape to a fortunate 1-0 win, a victory that moves them to the top of the table with 28 points. So hopefully Steve is okay now.
Well, the All Black
reflexes.
The All Black rugby player Wayne Buck Shelford famously played for the quite a long part of a game with an enormous hole in his ball bag and one of the balls contained therein hanging out.
Oh well, that's a really lovely way to finish, isn't it?
Oh, we can't finish on that note.
Steve Mildenhall, according to Wikipedia, is the goalkeeping coach of Swindon Town now, following the departure of Dean Thornton to the Taiwan national team. That's a better way to end,
yes,
isn't it?
I guess.
Paul, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Lars, thank you.
Thank you, Max.
Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
We will be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.